You're listening to a 3CR podcast recorded in the 3CR Community Radio Studio in Melbourne, Australia. If you like what you hear, please consider donating or subscribing so we can keep bringing you more independent community content. For more information, go to 3cr.org.au.
The 3CR Gardening Show is coming to you today from the Woi Wurrung Nation. We acknowledge the Wurundjeri people as the traditional owners of this land. We recognise the practices of care and cultivation of the land and waters by the First Peoples and pay our respects to their elders past and present. Wherever you are and wherever you garden, we encourage you to know whose land you're on.
Good morning, gardeners. I hope you're all looking forward to a wonderful program. I'm Virginia Haywood, guide at the Botanic Gardens, grower of Big Garden in Seville, chair of Plant Trust, and with me are Chris Williams from the an urban horticultural lecture from Burnley, Stephen Ryan, media, tour leader, president of Plant Trust, and with Dicksonia Rare Plants, wonderful nursery, and Meryl Johnson from Country Farms in Gippsland, who does seedscape. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
And last night was hot again. Weird.
Yes.
Having been cold. Having been wet.
Yes.
Meryl, did you get wet?
No. It's a very sore topic. These rain cells have been very, very patchy. And I'm addicted now, officially addicted to the Bomb Radar website, although I hate their new one, I have to say, because it doesn't have us marked on it. However, I've been watching the rain band split around us. Half goes north, half goes south, and we don't get a drop. So we're furious.
Yeah. Well, I could have sent you the hail the other day.
I would have been grateful even for hail because it would have melted.
Yeah, well, it would, but it tends to take all the leaves off things as it comes down, which is something I found this week. So, yes.
So Stephen, you got heavy.
Oh, God, yes. We got really heavy rain and then we got a whacking hailstorm. They were at least sort of pea size, possibly a little bigger. And, of course, when you've got fresh growth on potted stock, it just shreds it. I spent nearly all yesterday raking up green leaves that had been knocked off everything. And, yeah, so most of my stock is looking slightly weary at the moment. I mean, I don't think I'll have lost anything, but there's some stuff that's completely unsaleable for probably months now. It's just the way it is, you know. Yes. I don't know, as gardeners and horticulturalists in one form or another, we're always reliant on the weather and sometimes have to put up with these things. But, yeah, everything was looking fabulous in the nursery. I was feeling quite chuffed with myself that I had all my stock looking gorgeous for autumn. Now I don't. But anyhow, you know, these things happen. And, you know, people will still come, people will still want to buy things, and there'll just be certain plant varieties that if they're willing to buy them, they'll have to
a bit of imagination.
Yeah, they'll have to sort of look at it in the longer term. So I'm sure all these things will come good in due course.
But I have to say I'm having lots of fun in the garden because of the dry, just, you know, dry proofing and helping along the plants, just tending the plants, giving them a bit of TLC.
But Meryl, you do have water.
I do have water that I can apply, which I'm doing very judiciously because we don't want to overuse it.
But you've got it.
It's a natural supply, yes, yeah. We have got it.
I have bought water for the first time in 20 years.
Oh, wow.
And that's because it was so dry in winter.
Mm. Yes.
Yes, things didn't top up properly.
No.
Oh, dear. Oh, well, can we...
Chris, what about you?
Yeah, obsessively checking the bomb. with exact. I've been in the same split zone. But I must admit, just the rain we have had has been great. And I took photos of just turf in parks in early February near me when it was just browned off and yellow. And it's already green after only 40 mil. So, I mean, that's 6 weeks of no rain, at least in Melbourne, from December through to February.
They were talking about, I heard this on the ABC, they said that January was the driest January since 2007.
Yep.
And Port Fairy has had the driest January on record. Port Fairy, there by the sea where the rain comes
in. Yeah, that is odd.
And I think, you know, I think we can all relate to the fact it's not just the dry, it's just the intense UV, you know.
Yes.
I have had a bit to do with central western New South Wales and further north for many years, and I kept thinking, God, this looks like Coonabarabran at the moment, right? Like, I mean, just that scorching. Even though the rainfall up there is actually higher, technically, on an annual basis, just that sort of
intensity.
Yeah, the intensity of the light, the scorched look, I think. And a lot of plants don't like it anyway.
It is true. I think we're needing to think about some of our plants.
Yes,
it's going to. Things are changing.
Yes.
Yeah. We've got to adapt with it. I mean, when I started out as a young horticulturist decades ago, I was having fun growing gentians and blue poppies and lots of rhododendrons.
Did you actually grow blue poppies?
Yeah.
Did you flower them?
Yeah.
More than
but
once?
I can now say to myself, I've been there, done that, because yeah, there's
I
no
don't
way
need
I'm
to
gonna,
do it anymore.
I'm not going to attempt it again. No. It's just pointless. And I've got a tiny little clump of gentian in the garden at home that's still surviving, but I haven't tried to propagate it and sell it for donkey's years, because who's going to grow gentian?
Mm.
I mean,
our
climates are so
should
different.
We? Should we?
Probably Craig.
Yeah. Well, yeah. As gardeners, though, that's part of the conundrum.
The holy grail thing, yeah, isn't it? You have to do it.
Yeah, there's these plants out there that we all lust after.
Exactly.
And although we should be sensible, since when is sensibility something that gardeners really follow? I mean, we all want to have the things we shouldn't have. I push things to the limit with frost hardiness, so I'm forever growing things that are probably borderline, and one day I'll come completely unstuck with some of these plants when we get the winter from hell, which is bound to come at some point or another.
But you've had the fun in the meantime, and you've had the beauty.
And look, I have to say, I'm very philosophical about these things. If something doesn't make it, there's a gap.
Yes,
you know,
exactly.
So you've just got to look at things that way, although it is always hurtful when something quite precious and rare decides to succumb, because you know it would be really difficult to replace again.
Yes.
And so that hurts. But if it's, you know, if it's something I'm just experimenting with, trying out, see how it will go in my climate, if I lose it, I lose it. You learn.
No, I was just thinking, there's always going to be extremes, and I'll never forget seeing bananas in Sao Paulo in Brazil black from a 40 or 50 year frost, right? So you think, I mean, that's banana country, obviously. Mm. So I'm not trying to downplay those extremes of cold or heat.
Yeah.
But there'll always be weird stuff that happens.
Oh,
right?
Of course there is.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's the fun of gardening, isn't it? Is rising to the challenge, which is what we're doing at the moment.
I've had all sorts of trees losing large branches. Like my Chinese elm lost its middle.
Yeah.
And the gum tree closest to the house came down on a very full part of my garden, which has now got lots of empty space.
Oh, you've got some gaps.
There's a massive stone pine near me in
Hedgeley
Dean Gardens, heritage listed.
Where is it?
Hedgeley Dean Gardens in East Malvern. Quite a well-known tree, absolutely magnificent, well over 100 years old. And about a huge portion of its canopy came down because of the dry, and it's now condemned. So, just the scale of this branch.
That is so sad.
But what's fascinating is the sign is up saying our arborists tell us this tree has to go. And it's interesting that I'm not saying people haven't stopped and looked at it in the past because it's so magnificent, but now people are seeing this huge sort of where it's wrenched off. The amount of people that just stop and stare at this thing, it's made it unfamiliar, right? Because people are saying, wow, that could have easily have killed someone, or look at that, how magnificent it is, but it's gone.
Oh, dear. That's part of the problem with I would hate to be on the heritage register, because you register stuff and 5 minutes later something awful happens to said stuff. Because you're registering trees that are often really old, so therefore some of them are probably at risk. So you register something and then before you know it, it's not there anymore. Seems sad.
I heard a very interesting podcast a few weeks ago, and the main speaker was the head tree person at Kew Gardens. Mm-hmm. And one of the things he said was that the Woodland Trust is actually moving. The Woodland Trust is absolutely obsessed with native trees, which is understandable. But, of course, in a city like London, where you've got such a heat sink, they're hafting. The Woodland Trust is actually beginning to acknowledge that things are changing and they might have to be a little bit more flexible. Like Kew in 2022, it had a really bad heat wave and drought, which there was one in the 70s. I remember my cousins were living there and they were wearing jumpers because where they came from in Australia, and everyone thought they were mad because they were in a heat wave. You know, and in a heat wave in London, it's 28 degrees and everyone's sweating.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that was one in 100 years. Well, now these heat waves are happening every second year. And in 2022, 460 trees died in Kew Gardens.
Gosh.
That's huge.
They've got 11,000 trees, but that's huge number.
And presumably they don't irrigate.
They do.
Oh, they do now? Now? Or
oh, well, they do a bit. They don't massively irrigate. Well, they have, I mean...
Not that they should necessarily, but...
You haven't had to in London. I mean, you water, you don't irrigate.
Mm.
It's a different concept.
No,
but Kew, of course, is on very sandy, gritty soil, so it doesn't retain the water. He was saying that Wakefield, which is Kew in the country, isn't having the same problem.
No, well, they've got a heavier clay. Soil. Yeah. Mm. So, yes, they'd be holding moisture better.
But they are now talking like the Melbourne Botanic Gardens. They're talking about the turn of the century, what's happening. They're saying there'll be a 4-degree increase by the turn of the century, and they are looking at the worst-case scenario, because there is no sign that there's going to be any real activity from the powers that be to stop the carbon.
Sure. But, you know, the amount of exotic plants in London, and this goes back, you know, 2,000 or 3,000 years, perhaps 2,000 years to the Romans, that pop up anyway with urban heat island effect pre-climate change is fascinating.
Mm.
So I've got a cousin in London whose stepdad is in a small ecological society in North London, and he has recorded things like Acacia dilbata germinating and growing quite well, like meaning an Australian species, and he gets so excited. He's just completely into the kind of novel ecosystem, feral landscape.
Yeah.
And then they love to declare, this is now a native plant. They'll say, we've got one, welcome to London, you'll be here forever now.
Yeah.
I mean, but I've seen it too. I've seen, you know, in Sheffield, for example, in the north, that's a very big thing there where this... warm water used to come out from factories, you know, for making cutlery and all the rest of it that Sheffield's famous for. Figs grew in the 19th century and they're still there. So they're rapt about that. But figs pop up in London all the time. Yeah. I mean, like here.
But what's happening is the English oak is under threat.
Yes.
And they're not going to plant any more English oaks, which is how the Woodland Trust got in on the act, because they're totally horrified. But they said, you know, we have to plant for 200, 300 years. We can't be planting English oaks. They're going to plant Turkey oaks.
But
they're going to plant holm oaks.
Wow. I mean, that surprises me, because so-called English oaks, European oaks, Quercus robur, are very tough in Melbourne and they're regarded as one of our climate change-ready trees.
And they're wonderful because they don't burn. So they're good around the house.
You know, and I can remember being underwhelmed. Sorry, I sound pretty ignorant here, but been going to Sherwood Forest... You know.
Likewise,
so just hopelessly romanticising what I was about to experience, and looking at
somebody in green tights.
Precisely. And just thinking, hang on, this ye olde oak that I'm meant to be is about half the size of some of the older oaks in Melbourne.
Exactly.
Well, I parked under an absolutely stunning one yesterday in the patch. I met Jeremy from Cloud Hill for lunch, and the oak I parked under was just huge.
Well, I regularly get people who come in because, of course, Mount Macedon's got a long horticultural history as far as Australia's concerned, and there are some massive oaks, mainly Canary Island oaks around Mount Macedon. They're the really big ones. And you get English visitors say, well, they must be 300, 400, 500 years old, they say. And I just... glibly say, yeah, the Aboriginals planted a lot of oaks back 300, 400 years ago.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, so they grow so big here.
And they grow, lots of things grow much faster here than
it'll be interesting actually in due course to find out whether, because they're growing faster, do they die younger or do they just get bigger? I think we're still on the crux a little bit with that one. Certainly I'm leaning towards senescence coming in earlier because the trees grew really big.
Me too.
Yeah, so
they grow faster.
But I'm not sure that the judgment is made yet. But yeah, we've got some monstrous trees up at Macedon that certainly shouldn't be that size and wouldn't be that size in their natural habitat at the same age, because they also don't have their natural predators either.
But that's always been one of the things about Melbourne Botanic Gardens. It's had such an extraordinarily wonderful climate.
Mm.
That it grows like the Monterey cypress is five times bigger than it grows in Monterey.
Yeah.
And New Zealand and Melbourne have got the biggest in the world for that reason.
Yeah, your native habitat can actually be, genetically speaking, suboptimal. That's the point. It's just,
Well, look at Pinus radiata. It also comes from the Monterey region, and it's a scruffy, miserable little thing in the wild.
Yes.
And quite rare, so it's actually under threat in the wild. And here it is going gangbusters and feral in Australia and growing up.
We're pulling them out.
Enormous sizes. I mean, have any of you been to Wombat Park, the big garden in Daylesford, not the botanic gardens, but the private garden there? They have got a couple of Pinus radiatas there that the bases of them would be as wide as this studio. And they are, I mean, I don't like radiata as a tree usually, but these are just so big, so grand, so impressive that you look at them in awe. They are just enormous trees.
And I have to say, the black cockies adore them.
I've got them all around my property, and when I first moved there, I wanted to get rid of some of them because they block some of the view. And then I realised that we've got rid of so many other things that the black cockies need. And they get up there. I'm sure they're throwing things at me.
They do. I'm sure they do it on purpose. They're wicked
they
and evil.
They are wonderful birds, though. They are funny birds.
Yeah. But they have worked out pine trees. I have to say, you mentioned stone pine before. I wouldn't want to have a stone pine plantation anymore now that the cockatoos and what have you have worked out the
how to open
source.
Them up.
Because you'd never get a stone pine cone anymore.
The stone pines are the ones that the pine nuts that we eat come from.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So you wouldn't, in fact, be able to do it
to harvest
country.
Them.
No. I keep my eye on the Little Macedon Cemetery's got some beautiful ponderosa pines in it, and I walk through there regularly, hoping that I'll find a pine cone with some seed in it. Not a one ever. I've been looking for
and
probably 5 years.
I still find radiatas popping up around me.
Yeah.
Which I don't want.
No. Well, I think they're less, though. I think they are less than what they were. I think the cockatoos are actually controlling radiata to a certain extent because they're eating such a large quantity of the seeds. So,
and this is a reason for people not taking them down.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah,
definitely.
It's a food source.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's this, you know, people say, oh, we must plant natives for our native animals. But, you know, what feeds off our orchard trees? Native animals, all of them, possums, parrots, the whole kit and caboodle will come in and have a go at them, and it's a food source. Mm. So unless you're netting or doing something else to keep the animals off your trees, you're not going to get the fruit, the wild animals will.
We have to net our plum trees. We've got some dwarf plums, which are, and the flavour is just magnificent, but the parrots eat them when they are about the size of a pea.
Yeah.
So they have to be netted the moment the pollination is finished, otherwise you don't get any plums.
Well, I have a very large dog called Luna, who when she came to us, she was 50 kilo. We've got her down to 45. And she has turned out to, she thinks she's a person, which is a problem. And people eat fruit, so she eats fruit. So the base of all the apple trees, gone. Persimmons, last year I put a temporary fence around the persimmons to stop her. I saw her one day. She spent about 3 hours working out how to knock it down.
And she's got the weight to do it.
And she's got the weight to do it.
Oh, dear.
So the parrots take the top, Luna takes the bottom, and if I get an occasional thing in the middle.
Oh, dear.
And I love persimmons.
Yes, they are one of those great fruits, aren't they? I adore them.
Yes, but dear, I can't possibly stop any, even when, I mean, I found a dead native rat, and I did not poison it. I don't poison rats because of the eagles. And I thought, oh, my God, I've got native rats. I thought I only had black ones. If I've got native rats, I'm going to have to be more respectful. Mm. However, I do have black ones and I hate them. I'm allowed to hate them. I hate rabbits. I'm allowed to hate them.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
And we have an awful rabbit plague at the moment because we have had wet years till this year.
Of course.
Yeah, no, because it's dry, they've bred up. Lots of people are having rabbit problems.
Mm.
This is the 3CR Garden Show. I'm Virginia Haywood, and with me are Stephen Ryan, Merrill Johnson and Chris Williams. We've just been talking about trees, and I think one of the things we should, given that Kew is having this massive crisis about trees, and it's definitely been happening, well, Melbourne Botanic Gardens is more sophisticated than having a crisis in that they've been planning for it.
Mm-hmm.
And when the white oak came down, the only oaks that went in around to replace the white oak were from two from Mexico and one from America, very southern America, so almost Mexico, probably was Mexico at one stage. And, of course, there are more oaks in Mexico than anywhere else in the world.
Yeah, it's a huge array of them that grow in that part of the world, and some wonderful looking ones. I mean, lots of oaks that don't look like what we
ordinarily
think of as oak. And that's what makes that genus such a fascinating genus, because there's just so many different species, and you've got evergreens, deciduous, you've got dwarf ones. I mean, I grow Quercus pumila, which only grows to about a metre and a half tall, and they were it's talking, a suckering oak.
They were talking about that for Q. I couldn't think what pumila was.
Yeah, it's a little dwarf creeping oak, and it's the weirdest looking thing, and it has long, narrow leaves on it. Doesn't until it gets acorns on it, you wouldn't pick it for an oak unless you're already in the know.
What does pumila mean? Because ficus pumila is obviously a creeping fig, right?
Little.
Yeah. There you go.
Yeah, pumila is just little. And so it's an appropriate name for an oak that only grows to about a metre and a half tall. There's a good colony of it in the Melbourne Botanic Gardens because it suckers, so there's a nice colony of it. But, of course, it's one of those weird things. If you've got something that's a real outrider in a genus, if people want an oak tree, they don't want something that grows to a metre and a half tall.
They're not thinking about that.
No, and if they want something that grows to a metre and a half tall, they don't think about an oak. So plants like that, it's like jasmines that are bushy instead of being climbing, tend to fall between stools because people, if they want a jasmine, they're assuming they're going to have a climbing plant. So they're not going to ask for a shrubby one or a shrubby honeysuckle or, you know, all those different groups.
I have the most wonderful shrubby honeysuckle, like the Siberian honeysuckle, and it's totally wonderful.
Gorgeous shrub.
Can I just invite people to ring in if they'd like to join in this conversation? You can ring in on 94190155 or you can text us on 0488 809 855. And people are texting us much more than they're ringing in nowadays, which we don't like.
I'd like to talk to people.
Yes, and also when we're answering a query, often
it's good to be able to ask a question of them to get the information. Yeah.
Absolutely. And somebody stopped me on the Warby Trail the other day and said, "You're Virginia from the Garden Show, aren't you?" And I said, "Yes." And we got into a conversation. I said, "Why, you listen a lot?" She said, "Oh, yes, I always listen." I said, "Why don't you ever ring in?" She said, "Oh, no, I don't want to interrupt your flow."
Please.
I've had that a number of times. Yeah. So, yes, interrupt. Do give us a ring.
Yeah, because part of the whole point of being here is, in fact, to engage with people and give them advice and help
swap
them with
ideas,
their gardening.
Swap ideas.
Yeah, so
often
please
they've
do ring in.
Great ideas.
Now, we do have one text already.
Yeah.
From Vicky, and she says, "Yesterday we visited, is it Camesborough Gardens in North Road, Brighton? They have many old trees. Some are National Trust listed and others are quite rare. One of their Arcaria bidwillii is dropping large cones at the moment." Oh, how wonderful.
Yeah, absolutely.
I remember hearing something in the ABC a boriculturalist or tree studier of some sort or another said the way he wanted to go was to get hit on the head by a bunya pine nut.
Yeah, it's certainly the guaranteed end of life.
Yeah.
You can definitely be unalived by a bunya.
And why did they plant so many bunya pines in institutes that were once called lunatic asylums? They had big bunya pines at Kew Cottages. They've got big bunya pines up at Mayday Hill in Beechworth. Was it to get rid of clients or to create new ones is what I want to know.
It was to create an otherworldly experience.
Yeah, but it was an odd choice of tree for those sort of places.
The bidwillii is the bunya pine.
Yes.
Correct. Yes.
Yeah. So one of Australia's iconic trees and one of the weird-looking trees that has never been, that scrubby old thing from the Australian bush when we went through that era where Australian native plants were seen as something you cleared out.
Mm, yes.
The bunya pine was something that in Victorian times they saw as being an appropriate and important enough specimen to plant. So you'd have bunya pines, but they wouldn't have a eucalypt.
Except for, not to correct my esteemed fellow radio person here, but blue gums were an obsession of the Victorians. Absolutely.
Yeah, although you didn't see them in gardens around our area so much. You always see a bunya.
They did take them back, didn't they? To England.
Yeah, but also, no, I just say this because I read that Georgina Whitehead talks about this in her book on Melbourne parks. Just they were seen as this kind of beautiful. I mean, there's a kind of myth about the shedding bark and all the settlers. Everyone freaked out and thought, "Oh God, these aren't normal trees." And I'm sure a few people wrote about that. But there was also a great appreciation for that aesthetic. And blue gums, they were planted everywhere in Melbourne.
Geelong too. Geelong Botanic Gardens had a lot of them in the early days.
Yeah, so they, so there's a kind of a... But I agree with Stephen that the certainly the kind of gardens I saw as a kid growing in the 70s became, you know, the tormented grevillea, rosmarinifolia, sort of all twisted and not pruned. So there was a kind of a reaction against that kind of 50s, 60s native shrubbery, I think.
Yes, well, there was all those ones in the... When I was at Melbourne University, you had these... We all lived in these tiny little houses.
Yes.
And a whole lot of them had the most massive pine trees growing... I mean, eucalypts growing in the front,
Huge. I did it myself as a young gardener. The nursery and lied to me. He said it was only going to be 3 metres. He should have made that 30, I think.
He probably should have said in 2 years.
you know, there's a in the book My Brother Jack that we all had to study at high school, those of us of a certain age, perhaps my age and above, there's a fantastic few pages where the husband, I've forgotten his name, which is basically the author, really, just disguising himself. He's living in Brighton with his bride, and he's just sick of this neat garden and the neighbour who fusses over his petunias. So he goes to the nursery and says, "I want a huge tree for my front lawn that just dominates." And the nurseryman says, "Well," so this is meant to be the 1930s, says, "Well, I could give you this sugar gum, but I don't think people in that kind of estate that you've bought into like that." And he said, "No, I'll have it." And this thing just grows metres every over a few years, starts to suck out all the moisture from the lawn. So, no, anyway, it's just a fantastic sort of neglected piece of our literature which sort of looks at the presence of native plants, especially eucalypts, as something that was a bit rebellious at the time.
Yes, well, lemon-scented became one of the things that were planted everywhere, didn't they?
Oh, yeah.
Yes. And they are a totally magnificent tree.
They're in my top three trees.
What are the other two?
Well, I'd put... The Australian Araucaria in there, I think. Oh, no, hang on, it's going to expand already.
Sorry, I'm to three.
Definitely Eucalyptus camaldulensis, I just think.
Yeah.
Both planted and natural. Maybe an Agathis robusta. Mm. And actually, I would put in a Quercus, probably Canariensis.
Canariensis is a pretty impressive tree, I have to say.
Quercus, yeah.
All of your choices, though, wouldn't be very good in a terrace house in Fitzroy.
No.
Although, but funny to say that, because I think those images of those 1970s nationalistic Aussie eucalypt plantings, that's what I'm going to call them, look incredible. As long as your terrace isn't, you don't own the terrace and it's not falling down. Mm. A huge white trunk in front of a
absolutely
terrace house in Carlton or Fitzroy looks amazing. I wonder how many of them are left. They've all been, because that's what we like to say at Burnley, that the Eucalyptus caesia or caesia, however you say that, is the thinking person's eucalyptus of the sort of 90s onwards, right?
Yeah, but how often do you see a really good one of that?
I agree. But what I mean is the 1970s person planted the giant eucalyptus.
Yeah. Yes.
And then the sort of new millennium Northcote sensitive person plants a eucalyptus case, with a few indigenous grasses.
And now they're planting mallees.
Are they? Probably.
Well, I think because you get such wonderful flowers.
Sure. Yeah. Oh, I'll tell you what people do love is the West Australian one with the giant yellow flowers. What's that called again?
I've forgotten. I know the tree. You all need to go to Melton Botanic Gardens and look at them.
Yes.
Fabulous collection out there.
Look, I've got to get out there.
Chris, you've got to go out
to
Melton.
It's on my
list. Yeah, put it on your list for now.
It is so wonderful.
Yeah,
it's Melton Botanic Gardens is so, I mean, it's unbelievable that it's so young and yet it is so magnificent.
Its only drawback is it's against the freeway, so you've got this buzz of vehicles going past all the time. But the plantings are wonderful.
Yes, and they're very clever out there. They really think about it. Great planning. Mm. But my bugbear at the moment is urban heat bubbles. And this is one of our fun games whenever we're driving home from Melbourne. It's going along the freeway. It's a fairly boring drive. So the car records the temperature in Melbourne and then we watch the temperature drop as we go to the outer suburbs, out into the countryside, and finally up into our forests, and we are often 5 degrees cooler than when we started in Melbourne.
And this is exactly why we need to be planting trees in Melbourne.
So, and can I put a... even though I've just written an article for Your Garden magazine on small trees, even in that article I point out to people that basically the air's free. And so a taller tree is often a far better bet. And it pulls your house down into the environment so that it's not the dominant thing. And... if you lift the skirt of a tree, it can almost always grow as big as it wants. I mean, correct. You know, people get frightened of taller trees, and I'm forever people coming into the nursery saying, I want a tree for the front lawn. And I say, how big do you want it? And they say, 3 metres. And I say, you want a shrub. You don't want a tree. You want a shrub.
Well, some of my favourite small trees for urban gardens are indeed large shrubs,
yeah.
But they're big enough to sort of be a tree. And I particularly, Stephen was just talking about tall, slender trees, beautiful, of course. But I actually love and prune for the architecture of multi-trunked spreading trees. And I was thinking about what was my favourite tree for a small urban space. And I reckon I agree with Stephen, it has to do lots of duties. So I lobbed upon the medlar because it's got a magnificent structure if it's pruned in its early stages. You just take out some of the branches and open up the structure, which helps the fruiting as well as the aesthetic of it. Beautiful big leaves, lovely shape to the leaves, felty texture, that looks great. Beautiful flowers in spring, white, almost like single roses and about the same size, with a pink tinge, so very attractive in the spring. Handsome summer foliage, goes wonderful autumn colours and does big attractive fruit, which are yummy to eat. So that's my lots of duties tree for a small space.
They were given a bit
space.
Of a shout-out on Gardening Australia, actually, the medlar on Friday.
Were they?
Yeah, and there's some really good ones at the Collingwood Children's Farm on the bike path there as it goes around the corner. But I tell you another tree, and I say this just to be a little bit provocative, make people, you know, do some pearl clutching. If you do it right, the genus Fitinia is not bad for a small... No, see, exactly. This is, look, listeners, you should see Fitinia's face. No. Again, I have an allergy to it, not literally, but in terms of like sort of association with suburbia. But every now and again you'll see one, and maybe not the cross Fraserii, but the... a straight species one, whatever that is.
Serrata, probably. Yep.
Allowed to get big, uplifted.
Yes.
And you think, oh, wow, you're a proper... And also, too, it's like anything. If you know the habitat and its ecological origins, and I had a student from Hong Kong where there's a diversity of Fitinia there on the hills, and then you suddenly think, oh, yeah, you're just this super tough thing from another place. Now, obviously... doesn't mean we have to plant it here, but you start to appreciate it just because it's ubiquitous and if you do the right thing to it. But like I say, that's just the there as a discussion.
Yeah, that's an interesting one.
I would never have put it in there.
Nor would a lot of us, I have to say. But didn't you say pearl clutching? Well, I'm clutching mine as tight as
I can. Yeah, absolutely.
But I have to say, you just jogged something in my mind, talking about Fitinia. Another thing I think a tree should do is be a bit unique and different from everybody else's in the street.
Mm. Yes,
I get
I
so sick of driving along and seeing the same thing planted again and again and again.
Pears.
So, those blasted ornamental pears. Yes, there should be...
They're lovely occasionally.
They stink when they're in flower.
But you know the tree for me that was of non-native trees in my garden that got through the drought, best of all, was the Judas tree.
Yeah, they are great.
It's a beautiful tree, small tree.
But why are we planting Cercus canadensis in its different forms?
All the time, and it's no good.
And we're not planting Cercus siliquestrum, which is Mediterranean in origin and does far better. And you can get a pink one and you can get a white one.
And a purple one. And
So
they're stunning, the siliquestrums and the Canadian ones. And, I mean, I've got that as well. And it is desperate for me to water it. Well, I don't have any, so I'm not.
Yeah.
But, you know, the Judas tree, the Cercus siliquestrum, it's just...
You're complaining
about the heat. I'm not hot.
Yeah, exactly. And it's a Middle Eastern tree, and so is a medlar.
And it loses its leaves as well, so the sun gets in winter because we still want that winter sun. Although I do think there's a point in planting on the northwest side of your house something that is big enough to give your house shade in summer.
Absolutely. Yes.
Because you really do reduce the temperature inside and cut
your cooling
bills.
Cut your energy usage, exactly. And even if you only got a small space, we were driving through suburban Melbourne the other day and remarking about how little space there was between the houses. The eaves are literally almost touching. But even in those tiny little alleyways between your fence and your neighbour's fence, you can do things because there are plants that go in all those different environments. You can green even a very small space, which is great for your soul, great for your own health. We all feel much better if we're living amongst green things and growing things and natural
and
things.
I've got one totally useless piece of information. Well,
oh, good,
it's not
I love
useless,
that. Yeah, yeah.
But acacias are the best tree at taking up carbon.
Ah,
and it needs less water to produce wood than any other tree.
Well, there you go.
How about that for a totally... I mean,
no,
it's
that's not
it's actually very
that's
useful.
A very good idea.
I want to throw something else in. Now that Chris has mentioned Fritinia, still reeling, but anyhow, that he's mentioned Fritinia, it does prove another thing too. When we think Fritinia, we think of a big evergreen thing with reddish-coloured new growth on it and heads of smelly white flowers in the spring. But it's a genus that's bigger than that too. I mean,
correct.
There's a couple
that's
of beautiful
right.
deciduous Chinese Fritinias, and one's called Velosa and one's called Bouvardiana, and they are stunning. They've got grey bark, they've got elegant arching branches, open canopies, fabulous autumn foliage, red berries, still smelly white flowers, but nonetheless. and particularly Bouvardiana is just a truly stunningly beautiful small tree, and you rarely see it planted.
One of my other favourites I was thinking about were crepe myrtles for that very reason. Yeah. You mentioned the beautiful bark. And again, it's pruning when they're young. It's important, isn't it, to get that
the
shape
and
there.
And then not turning them into coat hangers later.
Yes.
I think Peter May was on here a few weeks ago, wasn't he?
Yes, yeah. It was a great show.
I missed it, unfortunately. But he's got a great image that I now use.
You can podcast, my dear.
Yes, true. And Peter, if you're listening, I must acknowledge this image of yours from 2009 in my lectures. But he's got a great picture of Lagostroma indica crepe myrtle facing west, overhanging concrete, so essentially in an industrial area or an estate. After the, 2009, the 46 degree day, looking fine. Next to it, it was some sort of maple, we'll say Japanese maple, just completely fried, right? And a lot of us experienced that. Now, in other words, completely robust, tolerated the heat. And I mentioned Coonabarabran before, I can't believe I mentioned it twice today. They grow really well there, for example.
Of course.
And then my friend and colleague, Henrik van Leeuwen, well-known horticulturist in Melbourne, he went to China and he sent me an image of crepe myrtle growing out of the Great Wall of China. And he said, so now, here it is, the proof. This is why this thing's so tough. Like it was just literally just fine.
Growing
like a Protostomum undulatum, right, just doing its thing. So this sort of qualitative knowledge we can build up about how tough certain plants are is so handy.
And when we plant a tree, I mean, one of my favourite trees is dove trees.
Yes, if you've got the space, they're gorgeous.
Desperate to grow a dove tree. There is no way a dove tree is going to grow well next century. There's just not a hope.
Especially on your windy hill, I have to say.
True.
But, yeah, look, there's some iconically beautiful trees around the world, but some of them are things that you should visit, not try and own. Because, you know.
And you have to plant for 100 years. You must be thinking of climate change when you plant a tree.
Well, yes and no. I have some hesitation about this business about planting for the future because very few of us plant a garden that is going to be there in the future because the next person coming along is going to have a completely different idea about what they want. So when people say, how big does something grow? I'll say, well, how long do you anticipate living? Which is probably a rude way of putting it, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
You plant for your enjoyment and... Yeah. If something eventually gets too big, I mean, my garden's now, 35, 40 years old. I've got trees in my garden that are possibly getting a bit big for what I really wanted in the first place. I won't have any compunction about taking them out if I have to and starting off again.
Well, we've just had to take out a great big ash tree and it's a great case in point. We planted it and it's really... It came to the end of its life. It grew so quickly in our good conditions and it was becoming dangerous. It was starting to drop branches. We didn't want it dropping branches on people's heads.
No, fair enough.
We have got a caller.
Ah, caller.
How wonderful.
And it is Jill from Brighton.
Good morning, Jill.
Hello, Jill. Whoops, I haven't got her. What have I not done?
What haven't you done?
She's there somewhere. We'll find you, Jill. We will find you.
Line 7, does that help?
I don't know. No. Jill, are you there?
Nope.
Okay. We'll, Jill, could you ring us back, darling? I'm not sure if it's me or if it's...
Oh, come on, take the blame.
I think it's probably me.
Too many buttons.
No, yes, I'll let you ring back. And
yes, sorry, I can go on with the story about the ash that we've regretfully had to take out. But as Stephen was saying, gave us a gap.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's opened up an area of the garden that was very heavily shaded and very dry. So it's now, you know, a more versatile area of the garden. But it's left us a lovely stump. So now we're doing all sorts of interesting things. How can we use this stump to best effect? So it's an opportunity as well.
And what kind of ash was it? The Fraxon or something or other?
Yes, yeah.
All right, so, yes.
I think I'm going to make another attempt to get Jill.
All right. I hope she's there.
Hello, Jill. Hello.
Yep.
Hello.
So, Jill, it was completely my fault, and it's because we don't get enough calls. I've forgotten how to do it.
No worries. Well, I normally feel like I need to justify it by ringing up with a question, but just wanting to join in the conversation about large trees in suburban gardens. Yes, I planted a tube stock lemon-scented gum 35 years ago, and now I can't get my arms around the trunk, not even halfway, and it's glorious. I am so, and people say, oh, it's a gum tree, it's going to drop limbs on you, and I think, well, actually, it would be a good way to go.
Oh, good. Jill, I'm so pleased that you're looking at it that way. People get so scared of anything that's taller than they are.
Yes, that's right. And look, a couple of years ago, we renovated the house and the garden, and I got a fabulous garden designer, Meg Geary, in to help with that. And we both just looked at each other and said, well, the garden has to be designed around that tree. It's the centre point.
Yes.
Yeah, it's just fabulous. And it's...
You know, I think you should build around a tree rather than do.
Yes, I couldn't agree more. And it's dropped its bark recently, and the new bark is just this beautiful apricot cream, you know, not a blemish on the trunk. It just looks, you know, I thought, so much better than the silver birch, you know, because
And when you think of where silver birches come from, you know, they come from Latvia and Lithuania, and they're shallow-rooted. Of course they're not going to do
and
well.
And they're used to living in swamps.
I think I had four birches once, you know, many years ago, and, of course, one by one they all succumbed to climate change, and I don't really miss them. They're lovely, but
Chris?
Just out of interest, the silver birches, was that three of them in one hole? That was a real 90. I'm going to blame John Patrick for that. Honestly, I feel there was this hole. That was just your own three in one.
They were various ones. One was in the nature strip, and American canoe.
Wasn't the classic or cops?
That's right. I must admit, the first time I saw silver, catching a train from, I don't know, can you catch a train from Gatwick or Heathrow anyway, somewhere in England, seeing them just kind of feral, if you like, or on the railway batter, and I thought, oh, my goodness, this is just, they're just the acacias of Northern and Western Europe. They're just everywhere, right?
Absolutely.
Yes, well, look. Oh, yeah. Well, the last one to survive was the American canoe birch. It was tougher than the others, but then the possums got into it and ate off every leaf, and I just thought, this is all too hard.
Yeah.
And look, I also just wanted to say, Stephen, the horizontal hawthorn.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yes.
Has gone gangbusters. I'm so thrilled with it.
It's a gorgeous little tree.
A handsome
beast. In the end, I didn't plant it to shade the pond. I found another way of dealing with my... algae, but I planted it over the garden seat, so it's already giving me some shade. And on the 44-degree, you know, north wind gales, it did not turn a hair.
No, it won't. It's a remarkably tough little tree.
Yeah, I gave it a really good soak the day before, but, you know, it just came through. I thought, you know, for a a newly planted tree. It just was unbelievably tough.
So what was that tree?
It's the horizontal form of hawthorn called, unfortunately, Crataegus crassgarli pyracanthifolia.
which is why I didn't attempt it.
Yeah.
But, wow.
If you can say the name, you get elected on as president of the Horticultural Society.
Watch out.
Dear. Yeah, but it is. It's a great little tree, and I know of a few good ones around. I sold one to Tammy Fraser many, many years ago, and it's by her tennis court. They use it sort of as a pavilion tree, mm-hmm. and they sit under it. And her granddaughter, Tammy bought one for her granddaughter 2 years ago from me, and that's gone up somewhere up sort of Euroa way.
And it'll be perfectly happy.
And absolutely.
So another, where's it from?
Well, crassgarli is from Mediterranean Europe. Mm. The pyracanthifolia form, which is just a horizontal form of it, I don't know where that arose, but it would have the same hardiness as the normal cockspur thorn, as it's botanically known or commonly known. And but I have to say, they're most of these things are grafted onto an understock anyway. And, of course, an understock will have quite a lot to do with how hardy a tree is as well.
Yes.
So depending on what you graft it onto, and the grower I got them from grafted them onto the double flowered forms of the normal wild hawthorn, you know, the double pink and double red ones.
Yep.
They grew those up to a decent height and then grafted into the top, because I've had a couple of understocks shoot over the years and you look down the back and you go, what is a pink flower
coming from?
Yes.
But a good point, Stephen, to always, and I mean, it's so easy these days with the internet and you just Google it, where does this tree come from? And and if it comes from the Mediterranean basin and particularly the Eastern Mediterranean, you know it's going to do very finely here in our similar climate.
I have to say, Jill, you've done a wonderful thing. We've got three more calls to come.
Good.
Well done.
Three more calls. You've encouraged people to ring.
I will get off the line then.
All right. Thanks for ringing in, Jill.
Thanks, Jill.
My pleasure.
Bye. And I think next we have, this is exciting. This is Di from Pambula Beach, who I presume is Di, our producer. Hello, Di.
Good morning. How are you?
Good.
We did it.
I bet it's nice at Pambula Beach.
Well, it's raining a little bit.
Oh, well.
But we're going to go swimming anyway.
Good. Nothing nicer.
Yeah, so it's not cold.
No, not really. It never gets either cold or hot here.
Yes.
It's always mild, which does get a bit boring. Look, normally I'm in Northcote, as some of you know.
Absolutely.
And I've got two questions. One is a really strange one, but many decades ago, I was at Heidi out the back of John and Sunday Reed's house,
yeah. mm-hmm.
and they had a huge patch of Mechanopsis blue poppies.
Wow.
Out
really?
The back of the house.
Yeah.
Now, currently, it's all overgrown with ivy, but I thought, gee, I love old gardens. Somebody's lovingly planted these.
Yes.
And I knew even that many years ago that they were special.
They're very special.
I was at the start of my gardening journey and I knew they were special and I never forgot them. Did anyone else ever see them?
I never saw them down at Heidi, no.
I didn't.
I'm assuming that they were only a once or twice flowered happening and then they would have faded out.
The whole secret to them is atmospheric humidity. That's what they love. And we get those hot northerly wind days and you just kiss them goodbye.
Mm.
But if you've had them flower, you only ever need to see them once. They are just thrilling plants.
And they come from the Himalayas, do they not?
Yeah. They do.
Yeah. Himalayan blue poppies. So they're obviously not really adjusted to Australian summers.
They're one of those things, if you've got a special place, a very moist shade house that, you know, you nurture and pamper, you can grow. They do actually grow quite well in pots. They're easy to germinate. Mm. It's getting them through the summer that's the hard bit.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, I think often that's our problem. Other people have trouble getting things through the winter, but we have trouble getting through the summer.
Through
and
the
that's
summer.
Why I can't grow a dove tree. I can't get it through the summer.
You can't get the atmospheric humidity. Mm. Fortunately, Himalayan blue poppies are quite small, so, you know, you can control the atmosphere around them if you're absolutely determined to do it. And why not? They're just the most thrilling plants.
And Di, what was your other question?
My other question is about a tree, and the discussion about trees has been very wide-ranging and fantastic. I'm going to have a little north-west corner of my new garden, and the gardener that I'm working with says, take the birch tree out, it's not doing well. Mm-hmm. So the old birch tree that I planted 25 years ago might have to come out. And I wondered what tree could go there, or should I give up on trees?
Oh, no, never give up on trees.
No,
don't give up on
trees. Especially not on your northwest, because you need that shade in summer.
Yes, yes.
There's always good trees for there. And look.
And you need a deciduous tree there.
Yeah, I would put a deciduous tree in so that you get the winter light. And I would generally plant something that gets well and truly above the height of the roof, because then it's a proper tree. Otherwise, it's a shrub with delusions of grandeur. There's oodles of things you could put in. Many of the crab apples could work well.
Judas tree
would work well. There's oodles of stuff. I mean, you could put in a crepe myrtle, and as beautiful as they are, I have to say I'm finding them a bit boring because there's so many of them out there. So that's another problem I have with
the
some
other
trees.
Thing that might be good is something that will give her a long trunk. So that she's got access to the garden, whereas...
Yes. Oh, yes. Well, that's to do with things, pruning.
That
too,
is a pruning thing.
Too.
People think that trees naturally grow up to a certain height and then branch from there. Most trees in their formative years need to be managed, so you've got to remove lower branches and lift the canopy up. But there's plenty of things you could plant, and at the end of the day it often comes down to not what is the perfect tree, but what one you like best. Mm. And that's where you've got to look at it.
So everybody, give me one or two for a Norfolk garden.
Can I just put in one
extra
little issue though in that garden? On the nature strip is a very big melaleuca, a very hugely grown paperbark. It's big now, and that's very close. And then in next door's garden on the corner just over the fence is a eucalypt. I don't know what it is, but it's got corymbia flowers and vase shaped hips, so I don't know, or cones or whatever you call them. And so it's got native trees all around it. And the birch has grown very canopy shy from those trees.
Yeah.
Yes. So it's growing on one side and not the other. Mm. And so I think replacing that tree, anything that grows there will have a bit of...
heavy competition.
Difficult root competition. Mm. And it's clay for Snorskett as well. I've been suggested Myoporum floribundum, but my problem with that is I think that's going to end up being the birch or the cercis of the future. It'll be everywhere.
Well, Myoporum floribundum is not a long-lived tree and it's not very big.
Yes.
So. No.
So that's not a good idea. Can I just say we've also had a text in saying, can I plant deciduous... shade trees amongst big established gums. So
yes,
in a way,
yes, absolutely.
But this is the same problem as Di has got. Mm, so we need to think we could answer both those questions.
Yes. Well, I'm going back to my medlars because I'm a bit fixated on them at the moment. But there's actually two varieties commonly grown in Australia. There's one called Nottingham, which is a variety that's a smaller grower, more suitable for small spaces, has smaller fruit, but delicious fruit that can be eaten fresh. And then there's another variety called Dutch, which is much bigger growing, bigger fruit, and absolutely fabulous for making jams and jellies. And
Big enough? Will it grow big enough to provide the house with shade?
In a confined space like that and pruned accordingly when it's young, probably yes. Mm. And with its nice big furry leaves, it's a great heat controller during the summer.
So, Di, quick question. How far away from the house is the planting hole? And a supplementary is, with the other trees you just mentioned, are you already shaded, in fact?
The other trees are not doing a great job of shading. The sun still gets through.
Because they're not tall enough.
They are actually very tall. And a small new tree would be quite shaded by them. And it's about 3 metres forward of the house.
Oh, I see.
So it's not near the house. It's near the footpath.
Right.
I mean, they are incredibly competitive melaleucas. I know this from experience. Mm.
They like to suck up water.
They do. They have that extraordinary you know, great massive roots, very fibrous and deep. You know, trees by definition are, you know, as we call them in the business, stress tolerators, in the sense that if they're a long-lived tree, they're there for the long haul. And so there are, you know, like if you look at the rainforest, for example, trees will sit there under the shady canopy until there's an opening, and then, you know, they'll be effectively an indoor plant under the canopy for, it can be decades before they take off. That's, and they're usually not deciduous. So I'm thinking out loud here. I'm not sure. I can't believe how conservative I am with planting trees right by houses. I'm just thinking of
you the, need to get over that.
Yeah, no. I'm. Yeah, I think I've had too many. It's a bit like the eucalypts will be widow makers kind of idea. Everyone's so convinced that eucalypts are going to shed branches, which is not entirely true. It depends on the species.
I was about to say.
So not exactly. But I. So the birch at the moment, the silver birch, is not. So it's got dieback effectively.
Is it looking good or is it not looking good?
Well, it's actually looking, I think it looks really good.
Then
it is growing more to one side than the other because.
Well, that doesn't matter. Trees do that everywhere.
Light competition or whatever it is from the other trees.
But that can be quite graceful.
It's a Jack Monty eye. It's not a. Probably doesn't make much difference, but it's actually very healthy and well. And I have an arborist prune it and look after it.
Leave it, darling.
I'm keen to keep it.
Yes.
And simply get the arborist to help me raise the canopy so people can walk underneath because there'll be a gate there.
Lovely.
Keep it. And let it battle along.
Yeah, we'll send you our invoice for this decision.
Yes.
So, by the way, just a final point on this. I think, too, that with deciduous, there are things that shed their leaves very late. And there are things that sort of, you know, obligatory deciduousness drop their leaves quickly. That's an important thing to think through, right? Because there are types of Chinese elm, we know, that essentially barely lose their leaves in winter.
Yeah, well, pin oaks
and
are
can I just,
a great
if you did
point.
Decide to take the birch out for whatever reason, I'll throw a couple of ideas into the mix that you might like to think about that nobody else would suggest to you bar me. One of them is Acer pentaphyllum from China, the five-finger maple. There's only 200 of them left in the wild, apparently, and it has bamboo-esque like foliage. It sheds reasonably late in the autumn, but it comes into leaf really late in the spring. It doesn't come into leaf till November. So
which
it
is
starts,
a good thing.
Yeah, it comes into leaf when you need it to come into leaf, because earlier than that, there's not the heat. So
it's
Acer pentaphyllum. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So
that's perfect.
So that would work quite well.
Growing underneath. Gets
and
more
you can easily canopy it up. It has pretty, if not spectacular, autumn foliage. So Acer pentaphyllum.
And that would be good for our texture underneath big gum trees.
Yeah. And the second one, which is really bizarre and weird and different, trust me, is a thing called Calopanax septemloba. It's a tree in the Araliaceae family, so related to Fatsias, ivy, all that sort of group of plants.
Sounds
comes
horrible.
From Asia. It's beautiful. It has a leaf about half as big again as your average liquid amber in the same shape. So you've got this lovely liquid amber-shaped leaf. It sheds in winter. Doesn't tend to colour much. It goes sort of soft yellows before it sheds. And the trunk has huge, big thorns on it. So you've got this upright trunk. And
no
you've got
dinosaur
these,
will eat it.
No, and you've got these. I mean, they're not like a rose thorn that's going to go in and hang there because it's not hooked. If you bumped up against the tree, it'd hurt. But it's an ideal tree for the masochistic tree hugger. So Calopanax septemloba, I think, is a great little tree that you rarely see planted, and it's very elegant, and it will keep growing both sides of the tree, even into the shade.
Awesome. Thank
so
you very much.
So that's another possibility.
Okay there, Di, you've got some thoughts.
Thank you. They're fantastic thoughts. Thank you.
See you soon.
Bye.
Bye. Well, that was interesting. We now have another call on line 9 from Evelyn in Surrey Hills.
Hello, Evelyn.
Hello, Evelyn.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, everyone. Very apt that you're talking about trees this morning because I have to take out my blood good Japanese maple. Which is 25 years old.
Oh, that's a bit sad.
It has gone into our conduit under the paving where our electricals have gone through for our lighting. And it's gone through on the other side as well, through the conduit. of our paving area.
Yep. That's not the tree's fault, that's the conduit's fault.
Yeah, it must have a crack in it.
It's got to have had some sort of crack in the thing. It's very easy to blame the tree when, in fact, it's a structural problem with what's going on there. Having said that, that doesn't make it any better.
No.
You've still got this issue.
A big problem.
But could it not be that you could get the conduit replaced and leave the tree? If the tree's doing well and it's healthy and it's gorgeous.
No, it's actually lifted up our path and it's actually gone underneath our lower section of our walkway where there's no conduit.
Mm-hmm.
So it's lifted it up and we can't close our front gate.
Mm.
According to Stephen, you need to get over it.
That's right. just build a boardwalk.
Yes, well, it's coming out on Thursday, but I'm really reluctant to put anything, another tree in there because, you know, I'm just really scared.
I think that you need to have that conduit looked at, though. There is no point not having a plant in it.
It's like tree roots entering, you know, water courses. They'll only enter if there's a break for them to get in.
Mm.
Yes.
Well, yes, the conduit's open because it has an electrical wire going through it.
Yes, understand.
We need to get the electricity from one side to the other for our garden lighting.
Yes.
So that's how that happened.
I see. So the conduit was for garden lighting, in fact.
Yes,
okay.
It was for garden lighting.
I think with tree roots and that tree roots won't, you know, detect water through a pipe and then break in. But I do think if you have a giant tree, like if you can imagine the buttress roots of a, you know, ficus or any giant, or even just an edible fig, I mean, they're capable of swelling to the point where they can actually break a pipe, just by forcing it against another hard object, for example. But that's not the case with with your tree, with a maple. I doubt that very much.
But it's quite big. Yeah.
Mm. So no Acer palmatum, which of course blood good is, are that big a tree. If you're having troubles with this tree, almost anything else of reasonable size is likely to, in the next 20 or 30 years, give you the same issues again.
I'm just thinking maybe just shrubs, they're gardenias or something, because it's in full sun.
But you're going to get any plant is going to send its roots into that water source in a very dry time.
I think I will be looking at it very carefully.
Yeah, yes, well, you probably will need to.
A unique problem.
Well, and I'm going to say something slightly controversial now, unlike me. I'm not actually very in favour of garden lighting.
Neither am I, because upsets the
butterflies. Yeah, it upsets the animals and the trees and everything else.
I didn't want to insult our caller, but I'm a bit worried about.
If it were my maple, I would see it as far more important than the garden lighting.
I worry about the night flying moths and things that get completely disrupted.
Yeah, we've got neighbours down the street that have got lights all over the place, and it's like a Tullamarine Airport runway. And every time I drive down our street late at night, it drives me insane. They've just built this new white house and white gates and white everything, and they've got lighting all over the place.
I mean, it's just a beautiful gum tree, eucalypt trunk lit at night is a thing
stunning.
Of amazing beauty, but it does disrupt the flight paths of things.
Yeah. Yep. Evelyn, is that what you're lighting up, as Merle's saying? Have you got a specimen
tree? It was lighting up the specimen tree, the focal point.
And it is beautiful.
Well, see, the maple doesn't like it either.
No.
Sorry.
Obviously not.
Well, Evelyn.
So I guess that is...
It's trying to kill the lighting.
And look, it all sounds like it's all too late, because if you've got it booked in to be removed on Thursday, I think it's probably too late to do anything about it. But I would have looked at dealing with the root system in a different way and perhaps working out how you could readjust the paving and other things to allow for the tree. Sometimes... hard surface paving is a stupid idea in certain areas, and I'd get rid of it all and just put gravel down. And that way the tree can live with the gravel and work its way around through it. And I'm not so sure I'd be worrying about the lighting, even though it might have made the tree look rather lovely at night. It's probably going to be happier without it.
Well, yeah, Evelyn...
Well, I can do without the lighting, but I can't do without my entrance paved. Like, I can't do gravel.
Well, Evelyn, what we've done is we've given you lots of different options. Mm. So we'll be very interested to see which way you go.
Yes, please report to us.
Yes.
Thank you. I will. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Now we have got, I'm just passing around, where's my phone? I've been sent a photo.
Yeah.
And I'm just about to pass it to you, Stephen. And apparently Fermi has sent it in. It's a mystery curcubit, he says.
Uh-oh. Oh.
Sorry, I didn't notice that on the messages when I first sent it round.
Well, it looks like one of those, it's either a watermelon or a squirting cucumber.
Yeah, I think it's a spiky African cucumber. Don't you think?
Apparently it has spiky fruit as well, so I think you're probably right on that one.
Spiky African cucumber. There you go, Fermi. Now, I've got another question, and I don't know how to pronounce this, so nobody, Stephen.
I'll laugh if you
get
you it
will.
Wrong. Yeah.
Is Quercus tarahumara in Australia?
Not to my knowledge.
I don't even know is there
a native one rainforest Quercus in Australia, or is it just in the family, the Fagaceae?
There could be something in the Fagaceae, but not
a Quercus.
I think it's almost, apart from the few that go down into Mexico and head towards the equator, it's basically a northern hemisphere family, or certainly the genus is.
Yeah.
So I don't think we've got any here, not native anyway, and that particular species doesn't ring any bells with me at all. And I mean, I've had a lot of different Quercus in my nursery over the years, and I can probably sell you four different Mexican ones at the moment, plus quite a few North American ones, and I've not seen that name in any of my stuff. So I would have thought it would have come my way at some point if it was here. But, you know, that doesn't matter. Sometimes these things are there and I just haven't come across them. Mm-hmm. But certainly commercially, I doubt that it's out there.
I think I should now. First I should say this is the 3CR Garden Show. I'm Virginia Haywood, and with me are Chris Williams, Stephen Ryan and Merrill Johnson. I think we should do our community announcements.
Oh, what a good idea, because we haven't really done that yet.
Yes. So I'm going through these fairly quickly because I could spend an hour talking about them and I just don't think that's useful. The first one is the OGV, Open Gardens Victoria Annual Lecture Program. It's a talking garden design with plants at heart. It's on the 5th of March at Collingwood Yards, which is 335C Johnson Street in Collingwood. The next one is Open Gardens Victoria again. It's their Open Gardens next weekend. It is Ralph Bristow's Barwishian Garden, which is 10 minutes from Mansfield. Antique perennials will be there. We have one free double pass. So the first to ring in on 94190155 will get a pass to that garden. Now, there's a couple of native plant sales coming up. Cranbourne Growing Friends, Cranbourne Botanic Gardens, are having their autumn plant sale on the 14th and 15th of March from 10 till 4 at the kiosk at Cranbourne. The Australian Plant Society Yarra Yarra is having their native plant and book sale at Eltham Community Centre, 801 Main Road, Eltham, on the 28th of March. The Herb and Chilli Festival is coming up on March the 14th and 15th at Quail Road, Wandon. And on that, we should mention...
Yeah, there's not going to be a rare plant fair this autumn up at Wandon. So the Chilli Festival is the only one that's going on up there this year. They're taking a break for 12 months with the...
But they will be having their spring...
Yeah, the spring one, I believe, is going ahead nonetheless. And hopefully
next year, the autumn one will be back.
Yes, so there's a break in that.
Yes. Then April the 11th, there is a rare and unusual plant fair at Broughton Hall in Jindavik. And there's a tour in Mount Macedon on the 14th of April.
Yes, that's for Australians studying abroad. If anybody's interested, it's a four-day tour. We start on the 14th, which is a Tuesday. We go through to the Friday. It's pick up in Melbourne, and we stay at Hotel Bellinzona at Hepburn Springs, which is lovely. We have a couple of really good dinners. We visit a whole range of gardens. And because it's my stomping ground, we're going to a lot of gardens that I grew up with. And so I know a lot about some of these places that other people wouldn't. And so you'll get lots and lots of personal stories, some of which might be true. and so if you're interested in coming along, we've still got a few spaces in it, and I'd love to fill the tour because we're probably not going to be doing it next year. Get in touch with Australian Studying Abroad and have a chat to the fabulous staff there and get yourself booked in. And of course, that tour is all-encompassing. So there's, I think it's one meal that you can go on your own when we're in Hepburn, but everything else is paid for. And we get into quite a number of gardens that are rarely, if ever, open to the public.
Right.
And, of course, it'll be in April, so we should have the lovely autumn
foliage and should things be wonderful autumn colour.
So, yes, so 14th and ASA, Australian Studying Abroad.
And then the last one that I have – oh, no, I have two still to announce – one is the Fermi Creek Plant Collectors Expo and Autumn Show, which will be absolutely wonderful because they've run two shows together. That's the 18th and 19th of April. They've got more than 40 stalls there. I'm going to MC the speaker's tent, so it should be fun. That's Fermi Creek in 18th and 19th of April. And then Carbloom, the big plant fair festival, is on in Sylvan from March the 21st till April the 19th. So that's running for a month, and they've got whole paddocks just planted out with flowers. It's
fabulous.
You like
colour. You need to be there.
Yep.
Oh, dear.
And so if any of those interest you, have a look. I hope you got the dates, and you'll find lots of stuff on your computer if you need more information. If you want to give us a ring... Oh, no, I completely forgot to tell you. There are four free passes for the Fernie Creek Plant Collectors Expo. That's the 18th and 19th of April. So if you ring in here, 94190155, and we will give your name to the Fernie Creek mob and you will be on the gate. So 94190155, and if you want to send us a text, 0488809855. So, we've done nothing but talk about trees. I think it's rather wonderful.
I did bring along some suggestions to plant underneath my medlar tree, and sometimes that's really nice, especially if you've done your pruning whilst the tree, tall shrub, is low, small, then you can get the canopy up and it gives you lots of opportunities to plant underneath. One of my favourite things for planting underneath trees and shrubs, it's just a self-seeder, it'll just go abundantly all by itself. So once you get started, you're away. There's a whole family called Ami, which are commonly called Queen Anne's Lace, and they're beautiful when they're just, if you've got a little area that you can let them just drift around by themselves, absolutely beautiful because they have frothy, foamy heads, very, very fine flowers, but in lace cap sort of formations. The old original one, the wild Queen Anne's Lace, can get a little bit too big, I find, a little bit rambunctious. But there's a lovely one called Green Mist, which was developed for the cut flower industry. It grows much neater, smaller, and the flower clouds are lovely because they open green, go through a sort of limey phase, and then develop to pure white.
Is that the plant tag there, Merle?
Yes, that's a little... The little seed packet. They're also good scatter seeds. You can just scatter them directly in the garden. You don't have to do a whole lot of pampering. So you can sow them in the autumn now. Just make sure they're well watered while they're germinating, or just leave them to get on with their own devices and they'll start germinating once the weather conditions are right for them. But once you've got them in the garden, they will just gently self-sow, but superb cut flowers.
And you can scatter them in a fairly shady area. You can scatter them around the trees.
Yes, they will grow in full sun, but they're actually better with that little bit of shade, and especially if you've lifted the skirts of the tree so that there is good light levels underneath, but not necessarily lots of direct sunlight. But on the other hand, they're really good dry hardy plants too. They don't need a lot of water, which is a good thing to have underneath a tree or a shrub.
Excellent. We've got one more community announcement come in. Brunswick Communities for Nature, who are a mob growing indigenous plants for recreating urban nature corridors. And they have a stall at the Sydney Road Street Party today near the Wilson's Avenue Park between Union Street and Barclay Street. So that's the Brunswick Community for Nature have a stall there, and that's the Brunswick Street. Oh, dear. It's so hard to read these screens.
Yes.
That's today on Brunswick Street. So that would be fun. And in Brunswick.
Yes. Mm. All right. Well, I gave some or sent some images off to our social media person. So we probably should just quickly mention the plants I bought in. And they're all plants in the grapevine family. Now, we've talked about growing things under your trees. You can also grow things through your trees.
And I love it.
Yeah.
It's great.
You know, I mean, people come into the nursery and they want somebody to hide their shed, hide their fence, grow over their pergola, whatever, whatever. But they don't think about the possibility of marrying an appropriate climbing plant with an appropriate growing support, as in like a small tree. And I've bought three plants in the grapevine family, all of which are more obscure plants that you don't see around terribly much, which is part of the fun for me. One is a true grapevine, and most people are familiar with the ornamental grape, which gets quite large leaves and goes a brilliant scarlet in the autumn, but it is quite a vigorous climber and it needs plenty of space or a good pair of secateurs where you control it properly, but it does make a great cover for pergolas and things like that. But it could be a little bit rampant for most trees and things, unless of course you've got a really big one and you can let it go nuts. But I bought in one that you don't see around terribly often, which is Vitis vinifera purpurea, the purple-leafed ornamental grape. It's a much slower, gentler grower. Its leaves start off in the spring almost a grey-green, and by late spring they're already starting to get burgundy in them, and they go darker and darker and darker till by late summer they're a real burgundy, and then in the autumn they go scarlet. And
that's a useful colour plant, isn't it?
If you planted this on a rose arch with a white or red flowered rose, it would look stunning. If you grew it up through a silver weeping pear, it would look stunning. I can think of lots of ways to use it. It does get clumps of purple grapes on it that are fairly bitter, but the birds seem to love them.
Yep, yeah, birds will love them.
Yeah, but I wouldn't plant this necessarily over your pergola if you've got a terrazzo floor underneath it, because when the birds get to work on the grapes, it could
be a little messy.
It could
be staining, yes.
But it is a beautiful grapevine. And it's much more gentle than the ordinary ornamental grape.
So it's quite slow growing.
Well, for a climber. I mean, you'll probably get the best part of a metre a year on it, but
and
that's about it.
And so you don't prune it back, you just let it go?
You could let it go. I mean, you can prune it. I've got a friend who's growing one along under the eaves on a northern side of their house, and she just prunes it back to the main structure of the grapevine every winter. In fact, sometimes I go down and help her to do that so I can take the cuttings away. And it looks stunning. It is a really beautiful grapevine, so definitely worthwhile looking out for. Now, one that I think I might be the only one growing in Australia is an Ampelopsis. Now, the Ampelopsis are commonly known as porcelain vines or blueberry creepers. There's quite a lot of names for them. And this one is Ampelopsis aconitifolia, which means it has leaves like an aconitum, which is a monk's hood. So if you're going to give it a common name, I guess the monk's hood leafed porcelain berry might work.
but it's not poisonous like aconitum.
It's not poisonous like that, although the berries themselves are not edible. But it has the most beautiful, intricate leaf, like a monk's hood has. And the leaves go a bright yellow in the autumn before they shed. And the berries on this one, I've only had it fruit, I think, for the first time last year or the year before. And the berries ripen to sort of a buffy straw colour. So you get little clusters of berries all over it, which is quite pretty. And the third one is the variegated porcelain vine, Ampelopsis glandulosus breva peduncularis elegans.
Well done.
You could just call it elegans if you want. And it has this white marbled foliage on it. It also gets pink stems and pink tendrils. And gets
wonderful different coloured berries.
The berries are just exquisite. They're blue and they're turquoise and they're aquamarine and they're violet and they're purple and they're green.
And it's a lovely variegation, Steve, and it's gentle, it's delicate, it's not
in semi-shade, actually. It looks like light coming in from somewhere. everywhere because it's all dappily. And I think it's a charming vine. Again, it's not overly vigorous. It's quite easy to manage. It could be perfect again on something like a rose arch. It could certainly grow up through a large shrub without doing it any harm. So if you had, say, I don't know, large old lilac in the garden that looks pretty ordinary after flowering.
Or one of the big shrub roses. I love climbers growing through roses, especially things that flower at a different time of year. Or
I'm going to be rude about roses again, as I am regularly.
It's all right. I can stand it.
Yeah, you can cope. Years ago, they had a Heritage Rose Society conference down in Geelong that went on for a week and a half or something, and people were talking chromosomes and propagating and God knows what else for the whole week. And Zoe Minotti asked me to be the after-dinner speaker at the end of the whole conference. And I said, you know, I'm not a rose grower particularly, don't you, Zoe? And she said, yeah, but we've been talking chromosomes and all this stuff. We want something lighthearted. And so I called my topic, what to grow in front of or over your roses.
To hide them. Yeah, I know.
I have to say the American delegation that were there didn't quite get my sense of humour, I don't think. But anyhow, I quite enjoyed myself. So there you go. What can I say? And I had a book out at the time and I think I sold two copies.
Back to the Ampelopsis.
Yeah.
I planted the variegated Ampelopsis.
The little elegans one.
I think maybe 18 months ago.
Yeah. Mm.
So it's been through one winter.
Mm.
And I had a big pot, terracotta pot, and I knocked the bottom out.
Yeah.
So that there was lots of room into the soil. But that was to protect it from the salvias and things that are around. And planted in that, and it's just static. What have I done wrong?
I wonder with putting it up above the ground in the terracotta pot, maybe it's either a combination of not enough water, because terracotta breathes so well, and it may even be a bit warmer sitting up in a terracotta pot.
It will be warmer, I hadn't thought of that.
And, you know, we've had some pretty torridly
shitty
hot
days.
Weather, so I think it might have been better off in hindsight if it went into the ground, even if it had salvias and things around it, where it can get its roots down into the cool.
A lot of climbers don't object to competition. They're used to, you know, that's their adaptation.
Yeah.
They're used to growing with friends. Stephen, may I ask, how frost hardy are all of these little guys?
Absolutely frost hardy.
Good.
So there's absolutely no cold issues with any of these things in that grapevine family. Actually, what I should have brought down too, I've got a new thing I've just raised this year called Nechemius. It used to be in the Ampelopsis group, but it's been taken out. And Nechemius macrophylla, and its leaves are compound, but they're about, people can't see my hands over the radio,
much
but
bigger
they're huge,
than his head.
These enormous big leaves, and they go bright red in the autumn, and it has blackberries.
Wow. Sounds beautiful.
Oh, Nechemius is just gorgeous. I raised it from seed donkeys years ago that I got from Canada, and I hadn't done anything with it until last year. The plant in the garden set quite a bit of seed, and I thought, I'll sow something. I've got a nice little batch of them going now, and it is a stunningly beautiful thing, and it's got these huge leaves, but it's not an overly vigorous climber.
Where do you grow it in your garden?
I haven't got it in the garden at home. It's actually up at the nursery,
right.
And it's growing in the shade house, although I think it'll cope with a lot more light than I'm giving it. I think it's going to be a fantastic autumn-coloured vine that doesn't grow too vigorously. So the problem with climbers is that they're either outrageous thugs that take off like a rocket, or some dainty little prima donna like a Lepidurea or something like that that can be quite difficult to keep. So to find something that's in between, it's good.
It's just nice and hardy, but not too overwhelming.
Yeah. Yes, exactly.
David from Upway has rung in with a tree question for you, Stephen.
Uh-oh.
So we will say hello to David from Upway.
Good morning.
Hi,
good morning.
David.
Hello. How are you guys?
We're good, thank you.
Great. It's very exciting to ring in. I have never done it before, but I bumped into Virginia yesterday and she encouraged me to go for it.
Good.
Good on you, David.
Stephen, I bought the Greyyard Sutherlandia off you maybe in spring.
Yeah.
And it's looking a little bit sad because I had it in a full sun position. I've been modly coddling it with lots of sea salt and organic matter and sunshade. Do you think it would be best just to keep waiting and then see in spring if it reshoots better?
Is it in the ground, David?
Yeah, it's in the ground.
Yeah, all right. Yeah, look, I don't think you need to mollycoddle it because Greya sutherlandii comes from South Africa.
South Africa, exactly.
Yeah, and I've got one growing in the garden down at our local hall, which gets almost no attention. Occasionally we remember to go and turn on the dripper hose every so often. And it's grown apace and it's in full sun. It's on a slope so that the water gets away.
Yeah,
it might just be that it needs that extra little bit of time to establish itself to get away. So I just think I'd be patient with it. I wouldn't, I mean, there's nothing wrong with the sea soul and all that sort of thing. It's a perfectly suitable thing to give them, but you don't need to go overboard on it. Not for that plant anyway. Because
That's what I figured, because my the north part of my block is very harsh. So I've got the Dias contifolia and a Cassonia paniculata and this one, because I'm like, everything else seems to die.
Well, certainly if you're growing the Cassonia and you're growing the Dias, I would have put the Greya in the same bundle of plants anyway. And for anybody who doesn't know it, its common name is South African bottle brush, although it's not in the same family as our bottle brushes. It's in Greyaceae, of all things. It's in its own family. And it has these spikes of intense glossy scarlet flowers on it and big geranium-like leaves. It's a really weird-looking plant.
It is. I grow a few at Burnley, and I was gifted to me by Stephen Nelson, the former retired head of the hort team at the City of Greater Dandenong, and I love it. Otherwise, by the way, David, just go back up to Dixonia and get a full refund, obviously.
Yeah. That's right.
I'm not working with you on the radio again.
I saw it in one of the open gardens in Tilopia Garden in Emerald.
Yes.
I think it was open at the end of last year.
I want the third species.
Yes, well, Tilopia used to be a nursery, didn't it, David?
Yes, that's right.
So there's
it was a big tree.
There's two species of Greya here, and the one I think you got from me, I think, was sutherlandii. And rattle coffleri is also in the country, which has
a fuzzy-leafed one. Right?
Yeah, fuzzy-leafed one. But there's one that I want, and I don't. I've actually not checked out what it looks like. I don't think it's as spectacular as the other two, but one called Greya Finnegani, I think it is. And so there's only three species in the genus, and the family itself is quite small. I'm not altogether sure there's even another genus within the family.
Right.
So
See,
at one stage it was included with Melianthus. So great plants, though. They're really beautiful.
And easy to the one I have, easy to strike from cutting. Yeah.
I was going to say, if we can get the third one in Australia, then, you know, it's like the easiest plant trust ownership
ever. We'd have an instant collection. In fact, it will probably show up in a couple of years because I'm for Plant Trust's little quarterly magazine that comes out, I've started doing a series of small genera plants that could be collected, and I'm doing it alphabetically. Done B.
Years to go, yes.
Greya might be the G that I need when I get up to that point.
Perfect. Would I be cheeky enough to ask Meryl a quick question as well?
Of course.
Thank you. Meryl, I've got your seeds from the Armenian coneflower, which I've been in love with, and they've sprouted and they're in our flower bed. I think I've got six plants going on, so it's very exciting, but they're still quite small.
Yes.
I just wanted your advice over winter best practice.
Okay. I think they should be quite frost hardy, but if you wanted to make sure you had some good mulch around them, as long as you preserve the root crown, even if the top gets burnt off, they'll be just fine. So maybe just a nice, you know, sort of sugar caney, pea strawy sort of mulch around them just to protect those new young crowns. But once they're well established, no problems at all. Their native habitat is quite a heavy frost area in the winter, so no problem.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, guys.
Thanks for ringing in.
Bye, David. Do
it again.
Good on you, David. Thank you.
Bye.
We have another call on line 8, and that is from Eva in Mulgrave. Hello, Eva.
Hello.
Far away.
How are you?
Good, thank you.
First time listening and first time questioning on the phone.
Good on you.
Yeah,
good
job. I love
your
discussion about the trees, and I have a question about my elm tree. It's a huge and it's giving me sun in the winter and shade in the summer. But over the years, it got this bugs, which is elm tree bugs.
Yes, elm leaf beetle. It's a
beetle,
nightmare.
That's the one. Yeah, and the leaves is a bright green every year. Now in this year, it sort of really has a lot of holes in the leaves, and it's not really shining green.
Mm-hmm.
And it's struggling. Wondered. I don't want to go into those yearly spray, which is, I know, is very industrial, and I don't like any chemicals into into intervening with the nature. So I'll probably have to just see it going. What will be going like?
Well, unless you syringe the tree, which is the prescribed way of dealing with elm leaf beetle, and you need to do it at a certain time of the year, it's probably the required. It's better to get a professional to come in and do it.
Yes.
But if you're not prepared to use any chemicals in the garden, then you have very few choices. I mean, there's nothing else you can do to control the bug. So you've either got to live with the bug or live without the tree.
Slowly die.
It will have an impact on the vigor of the tree. It may be decades before it decides to die. It's
probably showing stress this year just because we've had that unbearably dry period after a number of quite wet years. So the plants are sort of struggling to keep up at the moment.
So there's nothing much you can do.
Eva, has it started to sucker at all? Is it what kind of specimen is
there
it?
There were a lot of suckers coming all around my garden because it's huge in my front yard. But I've been cutting the suckers out, so it's no suckering now.
Okay, and how tall is the? I mean, is it a very old elm? A huge, big trunk?
It's huge. Yeah.
I cannot
put my arm around my own body.
It's a treasure.
I think if you want it to keep it and for it to look good, you need to get somebody in to give it an injection.
Yeah. I mean, the chemical that goes into the tree stays in the tree, so it's not something that you spray into the atmosphere. I get where you're coming from not wanting to use chemicals, though. I mean, I'm on side with that myself. I don't use any chemicals if I can completely avoid it. But sometimes you've got to make allowances for something like this because there's no other prescribed cure or control. In fact, cure is something we shouldn't be talking about. You don't cure anything, but you might be able to control things by...
Give the tree a sporting chance.
Yeah, but so you really haven't got much choice. I mean, it does make the tree less attractive, which is sad. So it loses some of its ornamental value when it's covered in elm leaf beetle. And it's one of the very good reasons why I don't recommend planting of elms to anybody, including councils and things. As much as we're one of the last bastions of the European elm in Australia, I cannot see the point.
Not one of the last. We are the last.
Yeah. Yeah, so I just can't see the point in planting more of them, as beautiful as a tree they are. And they're not really a terribly good garden tree because of what Chris mentioned
the suckering.
Yeah.
They've got a very vigorous root system. So they're not...
We bought this house in 1995. It was already here.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
Of course.
Yeah. Yeah, so you don't even have to take the blame for it.
Also, they are absolutely beautiful trees, Eva.
Yeah.
I would be very keen to try and save it. We are the last stand of elms in the world in Australia. Mm. So they are important.
If I employ industrial team, it's not a spray, it's an injection.
Yeah, they come in and they inject the tree with the chemical that they use, and I can't remember what it's called.
Afterwards,
You won't even know it's been done, and it will give your tree protection for at least a couple of years. It doesn't have to be done yearly.
And you will, and you need to contact an arborist.
Yeah, a good arborist should be able to put you onto somebody who does it if they don't do it themselves.
I know some because I've been investigating. But thank you for the explanation. I thought there was going to be spray everywhere.
No,
you'll be safe.
Mm. Okay.
Thank you very much
for your instruction.
Thanks for ringing. That was very interesting. We've had another text. Somebody has planted crab apples, aces, smoke bushes, and they've been there for 18 months. They're healthy, but there has been very little extra growth. How do I encourage that growth? Mm.
Well, I think perhaps some extra water, but down into the root zone. So using some sort of a boring thing or hammering something hard into the ground, making some holes, letting some water get down into the root zone. They've sort of had a bit of a tough start planted in the last 18 months.
I have to say 18 months is not long to have to wait before things get their roots down and start moving.
I think next spring will tell you.
I agree. I think, depending on what other plants are around it. But, yeah, when you've had a six-week period of no rainfall, I think as Merle's saying, I'm assuming, what was your name?
I don't know.
It's on the text. Extra watering probably would have helped. But, yeah, certainly letting roots get established and then watch it take off this spring coming.
Yeah.
Is the way to
go.
So
they're
still
spring.
Alive, so they've done well in a pretty tough period.
Yes, if we had that crystal ball, we'd know which year we should be planting things and which year we shouldn't be. So look, I always say that things need a 12-month period to settle in anyway. If it's a nursery-grown plant, it will have been – it's almost like humidity crib conditions. I mean, they're growing them in good quality potting mixes, they're feeding them, they're watering them, they're giving them shelter, they're doing all of the things to make those trees grow fast so that they can sell them. But that doesn't mean they're hardened up to your conditions. They need to adjust to your soil, to your conditions, to the wind, to all the other things that your garden might be throwing at these newly planted trees. And they do. They take 12 to 18 months just to settle in.
At least.
Yeah.
And I'm a great believer, Stephen, or one of our callers previously mentioned it, about using the seaweed products as a tonic, not as a regular fertiliser, because they're not fertilisers.
Seaweed
tonics.
That's a very good point.
And that's what I'm doing at the moment because of the really incredibly dry period that we've suffered because of the rain missing us. We are giving a little pampering with our seaweed products.
Well, I think that's very good advice there. Now, Frank from Noble Park has rung in and he spoke, he wanted to talk about wanted us to talk about Wangari Maathai, a Kenyan environmentalist who won the Nobel Peace Prize. She founded the Green Belt Movement, empowering rural women to plant over 30 million trees to fight deforestation.
Wow.
And he says, you know, we cut down trees to put houses up. Mm-hmm. Here we have a woman who's encouraging women to plant 30 million trees because of deforestation. And we've got plenty of deforestation in Australia.
Yes. We certainly have.
Yes.
And once an old-growth forest is gone, we'll never see it back again.
Not in our lifetime.
No. We let people cut down too many trees. There's no doubt.
No, we should be putting more in. Get rid of those urban heat bubbles.
And the other thing Frank wanted to know is it true that oak trees can live for over 1,000 years?
I think there are species in Quercus that do live for 1,000 years.
They can be very long-lived trees.
There's some that are ascribed to be about 2,000 years old.
Of course, they're still not the oldest trees in the world by any stretch the imagination. I mean, the bristlecone pine is supposed to live for easily 1,000 years or more. I think they've got some that they've carbon dated to 3,000 years old.
And where are they?
They're in North America, right up in the Rocky Mountains, up in these really high areas. And although they're alive, great chunks of the trees are nearly always dead. And they live off little bits that survive in the really torrid and difficult conditions.
And they grow incredibly slowly, which is how they get to be so old.
And that's one of the things when you're buying trees, the first thing you don't ask is how quickly does it grow, because sometimes the really quickly growing things are also the short-lived
ones. Exactly.
And you mentioned acacias before. A lot of our acacias don't last terribly long.
They are trees that come in when things have been damaged and there's a space.
Yeah, they're pioneer species. They come in. Their roots hold the ground together, and then eventually the eucalypts and other things grow up through them and take over.
Now, you have another question, Merrill.
Priscilla, who from Pakenham, who asks, would it be okay to plant pink scaviola in the middle of a garden that has dogbane at the front? I can't see any reason why not.
Mm. Yeah.
It would be a lovely combination. Depends what scaviola you're planting. They can sometimes be quite low-growing plants, so you wouldn't want the dogbane to be dominating too much and causing like a barrier around the garden. But, of course, the dogbane can be cut back, kept as a really nice dense, clumping border plant and let the scaviola have its head. Sounds like a great combination to me.
There you go. Yeah,
no problem.
Well, that is excellent because that's exactly what we need. The next text, I just cannot read the whole text properly, unfortunately. So where are we? We're the 1st of March today.
Yes. So it's the beginning of autumn. Yes.
Come on, autumn.
Yes. Yes, I'm looking forward to it. And I know you didn't get the rain and we did, but we also got the hail, which was quite damaging.
Yes.
The days are shortening. It's dark when I get up in the morning to come down here.
I walked here in the dark this morning.
Yeah, well, there you go. And so the days are definitely shortening.
The temperature's moderating. Hooray.
Yes. Although, you know, it's beginning of March. We can still get a few really hot days.
Yes,
so
we can.
Let's not get too cocky about it. But
we have had many, many, many very dry Marches over the last decade.
We have.
Yeah.
And
I believe it's sort of moving later.
Yes. But we have had that rain this week, which will get us through now, yeah. I think, mm-hmm. which
I've
is a great.
I've got the radar open right now.
Oh, good.
You are obsessed.
Our favourite website.
Yeah. I mean, just fun fact, the mean average temperature in March in Melbourne is exactly the same as December if you add the minimum and the maximum and divide by 2. There you go. So it's effectively still summer. Just less light around.
That is interesting because the less light does mean that the mornings seem cooler.
That's right.
Yes. Yep. Yeah.
And we are getting a bit of dampness in the air.
There's some dew around, yes.
I love dew. Dew.
So do I.
such a very precious thing.
Worth getting up early in the morning to see it on the leaves.
Sorry, Mel. With 5 minutes to go, I'm just going to quickly hold up my very bedraggled Scarlet Runner.
Nobody needs to see that it's bedraggled.
No, sorry. I'm just transparency on radio. I'm into productive gardening and I really Scarlet Runner bean, 7-year bean, one of the first things I ever grew. I remember my grandmother planting it and telling me that it would come up for 7 years, thinking that was incredible. I've grown it over the years and then, it doesn't like the heat in terms of pollination because it's from the high altitude Andes or higher, right? That's why it's popular in England as an actual bean. Anyway, the point is, to keep this really quick, the fact that it has that period of sulking where it doesn't produce beans, that's fine with me now. It was, even though it started producing early because we had a cool November and wet, then definitely when the heat was on, it was flowering and flowering and flowering, but no beans, and it's just come back strongly. Now, the bean quality itself is probably a 7 to 7.5 out of 10 compared to a Purple King or a Blue Lake, like the lowland beans, different species, but I rate it. I think it's so...
It's really meaty.
It's a fabulous flavour.
That's right. Some people might even say it's on a par just because it's different quality. But what I noticed this year was that the beans that should be more heat tolerant, like Purple King, Blue Lake, Kentucky Wonder, all that group, actually really didn't like the heat for their foliage.
Yeah.
Whereas the Scarlet Runner bean didn't produce beans, but it's tough. So it's my productive plant of the year.
I'd vote for it.
And you put it in and it lasts for 7 years.
Exactly. So you don't have to keep replanting.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. So, bring it back, I say.
And I think they're very decorative. I have them growing over arches every year. They just do it themselves each year. And they're so pretty with the bright red flowers, the handsome green leaves, and the beans are quite large and long. So when they're hanging, they really look fantastic. So even if you don't eat them all, which is quite difficult because they're very productive, it's hard to eat them all, but great for sharing.
I had no idea they were from the high Andes because I have a chili that lives through the winter and it's from the high Andes.
Yes.
Go the high Andes.
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, there's some wonderful plants that come from that part of the world. And, of course, it is one of the places where some of our most important food plants came from.
Exactly.
Well, at this stage, I think we have to say goodbye.
Oh, it's gone again.
Thank you.
It goes so quickly.
Thanks, Virginia. Thanks,
guys. And thanks to all the callers. That was so much fun. Please call in again.
It is good. It does make it easier for us because of the to and fro.
Yeah.
It does make it easier than text.
And you learn.
I do respect and pleased that people are so nice to not want to interrupt our flow when we're going.
Sometimes we need interrupting, by the way. Especially me. No.
And next week, Emma will be back, and so you'll have another wonderful show, and I hope you are all podcasting the ones you miss, because, after all, some of them are very, very, very good.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast. If you found it valuable, please consider donating or subscribing to support independent community radio. To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au.